wanted to. She had to admit, part of her wanted to impress this man. But would admitting that she was a bastard impress him? She took a deep breath. My father was the Earl of Chichester. Now it was his turn to sputter.
Yet I found you working in a hotel. A grand hotel indeed, but one where an earl's daughter ought to be paying for a room, not cleaning it.
My mother was his housekeeper, if you must know. He would never recognize me as his daughter. He grew quiet.
You deserve better than that.
The unexpected kindness brought a lump to her throat. Certain lines must not be crossed. He reached into the picnic basket and drew out a small sketch pad and a fountain pen.
I promised you I'd draw your dream cottage, and I come armed and ready. If you like, you may describe a castle fit for an earl's daughter, and it will be yours. On paper, at least.
You really don't have to do that. She ducked her head to hide her obvious pleasure.
I insist.
He began by asking her simple questions. How many rooms she required. What type of stone she preferred. When she offered up the idea of an iron bench for reading under a trellis covered with wisteria, he'd smiled.
Grand idea. I knew there was something about you, the minute I saw you up in that dreadful office with a tiny window. You didn't look like you belonged. And that look you give.
Which one is that?
When you need someone to do something they don't want to do. Don't deny it. I've seen you give it to Daisy a dozen times. One eyebrow goes up.
She laughed. He had figured out her secret weapon. He continued on as he drew.
Speaking of moving up in the world, here's an example for you. What about our esteemed builder, the late Mr. Clark? He built himself up from nothing, and ended up owning half of the Singer Sewing Company and our beloved Dakota.
Like the sewing machine in the basement?
The very one.
I'm quite fond of Singer sewing machines. To no longer be a slave to the needle is a magnificent thing. However, she hesitated, but continued on when Mr. Camden indicated his encouragement. We both know Mr. Clark wasn't accepted by high society. Like London's peerage, in New York you were either on the list or not.
In 100 years, Mrs. Astor's list will be mocked. These demarcations are no longer important. Eventually the entire lot will have intermarried themselves into oblivion.
The forcefulness of his words shocked her. He leaned up on one elbow.
May I ask you a rather personal question?
What might that be?
What became of Mr. Smythe?
He never existed. It's for work purposes only. The tradition of lines and lines of housekeepers, probably going back to the Middle Ages in England, is to be a Mrs. The irony being that if a housekeeper did marry, she'd be out of a job.
Better off to remain unmoored to another person. Look at Mrs. Camden. She is a member of the land-rich, cash-poor aristocracy, and where does that get her? With an obnoxious American as a husband who refuses to play the silly games.
You have so much ahead of you, having taken the leap to come to this country.
I hope you'll take advantage of it.
His confidence in her future thrilled her. What could she become if she really tried? May I ask how you became involved in architecture, Mr. Camden?
You certainly may.
He continued drawing as he spoke.
My stepfather, a brute who worked in a grain mill, never liked my artistic leanings. He liked to say I might as well have been doing needlepoint. I drew everything, flowers, faces, whatever was in front of me. One late Saturday afternoon, my friends and I, troublemakers, all of us, snuck into a mansion that was being built outside of town. It was an empty shell. The framing had been completed, but little else. Inside, I found a set of plans, and while the other boys ran around playing chase, I studied the drawings like they were a treasure map, which they were. I was entranced and took them with me when we left.
Did you get caught?
Of course. My stepfather dragged me back to apologize, and the foreman insisted I work as a sight rat for a month to atone.
Sounds awful.
Oh no, I was in heaven, picking up nails, bringing the workers water, watching as the one-dimensional design came to life in three dimensions. Extraordinary.
He blotted the drawing before handing it over to her. The delicate pen strokes captured a handsome cottage with three gabled windows, above a trellis dripping with wisteria. A wooden door with a solid knocker was offset by a large window carved with diagonal muntins, and a smaller, round window on the other side. The asymmetry lent the building an unexpected jauntiness. She asked him to sign it, and he did so with a flourish before rolling it up for the ride home. On the way back to the Dakota, Sarah's bike hit a large hole. She stayed upright, but her front wheel began to wobble. She disembarked near the statue of Daniel Webster and examined the tire.
"Something wrong?" Mr. Camden asked.
"Looks like this needs to be tightened."
She pointed to the hub of the wheel. He leaned his bike against the statue and knelt down to examine hers. She wished he didn't have a hat on, as she'd have liked to see what the top of his head looked like, how the hair whirled this way or that. He looked up suddenly, his eyes wide. Her own expression had been unguarded. She gave him a quick smile and looked away, unable to meet his gaze. He stood, one hand on her bike seat, and spoke quietly.
"I'll have one of the staff take it to be repaired. Thank you for a remarkable afternoon, Mrs. Smythe."
The vibration of his voice practically undid her. He was so close, and it was as if the sound traveled through her skin and muscles and into her bones. She loosened her grip on the bike handles.
"Off I go, then. I must check in and make sure there have been no fires that need putting out.
Wait. You must take this."
He dug into the picnic basket and handed over the rolled drawing. The act felt overly intimate and improper, as if he were handing her a lacy chemise in the middle of a city street. She took the paper and hid it behind her back, embarrassed.
"Thank you, Mr. Camden."
She ran off without waiting for his reply.
"There you are. Sit and tell me the day's gossip."
Sarah took her usual place in Mr. Camden's library. Even though it was only 2 weeks since the opening, the Dakota ran as smoothly as if it had been occupied for 2 years. Boys brought coal up to the apartments, past maids carrying buckets and mops, while downstairs residents ascended into their broughams with the help of the porters. Fortunately, the new residents were far from the demanding upper-crust guests the Langham catered to, apart from the irritable Mrs. Horace Putnam. The men were debonair and kind, and the women, while discerning in their tastes, exuded an unexpected warmth. Not that her job was easy. While the delivery men were obsequious enough, the clerks of the companies they worked for balked when Sarah registered even the most minor complaint. Yesterday she'd shown up in person at the offices of the Kindling Supply Company after sending multiple letters complaining of damp bundles. The clerk refused to believe she was in charge, insisting that she instead send the true manager. She'd fired the company on the spot and directed Daisy to find a suitable replacement. Each day at 4 p.m, when Mr. Camden returned from his office, they shared tea and ran through the day's events. What a relief it was to speak with a man and not have to prove herself. He encouraged a friendly banter as if she were his equal.
"I'm afraid Mrs. Putnam's son wore his skates in the parlor. The floors will need to be redone."
Mr. Camden froze, cup half raised to his mouth.
"He did what?"
She smiled. I'm joking. Sorry, couldn't help it. She has insisted we polish the silver inlay of her floors twice a week, however. Mr. Candon burst out laughing and barely got the teacup back on its saucer without spilling.
That image will haunt me for days, thank you very much.
No gossip to tell today, I'm afraid. I hope that doesn't disappoint you.
Not at all. Between the good notices in the papers and the current resident satisfaction, I've been told we have a waiting list pages long for residents here at our private village.
He idly lifted an invitation from the table beside him.
That's a shame.
What's that?
The Rutherfords are having one of their mad masquerade balls on Friday. A Mrs. Camden would have loved to have gone.
Sarah forced a smile. His wife and children were due the following week. The apartment had been furnished with their overstuffed armchairs and delicate French tea tables, and was just waiting for the rest of the family to arrive. She'd so enjoyed Mr. Camden's company these past few weeks, but their relations would have to become more formal once Mrs. Camden arrived from London. It was only right. For the first time, she reconsidered her mother's relationship with the Earl of Chichester. Sarah had never been able to imagine how her mother had fallen into the man's hands, made herself so vulnerable. But perhaps they'd been united by the common goal of running a large manor, leading to shared confidences and a mutual respect that wasn't bound by class. The loss must have been insurmountable, if that was the case. Her mother's livelihood, and her love.
Mrs. Smythe.
She looked over. Had he said something? I'm sorry? Her face flamed with embarrassment.
I said you should go with me.
To where?
The Rutherford Ball.
No, of course not. He was mad. A glorified servant did not attend balls. He sat back and ran his finger over the thick cardstock.
Too bad, as I'd love to show you the interior work, and they're known for their soirees. Last year they held a costume ball for 1,200 people, and even the discerning Mrs. Astor showed up.
What was that costume?
Good question. I'll have to find out.
You always stump me. You know that, don't you?
In any case, there's no reason you shouldn't go unescorted.
I don't want to go for any other reason than to prove to you the level of inanity the world has attained.
That again. She hoped he wouldn't go off on another tear. I can read about it in the newspapers every day. There's no need to go to a ball.
I suppose you're right.
He sighed.
In any case, I'd forgotten we also have to find you proper clothes.
Sarah looked down in her lap. This morning, knowing she'd be performing an inspection of the basement rooms, she'd worn her gray day dress, her shabbiest outfit, and shame flooded over her. There was no use pretending to be Mr. Camden's equal, exchanging witticisms and teasing him, when really she was no better than a scullery maid in appearance and social ranking. Yet the man ought to be put in his place. I'll have you know that I own a lovely ball gown. He slapped his knee.
Of course. I forget that you're the daughter of nobility. How awful of me to assume otherwise. Then it's settled. We must.
He didn't give her an opportunity to answer.
It's a masked ball. I will introduce you as my second cousin from England. We will enter, I'll give you a quick tour, and then we'll leave. It's the perfect opportunity, perhaps the only one.
True. Other than being hired as their housekeeper, Sarah would never set foot in a house like that in her life.
Please go with me, Sarah.
The use of her Christian name stopped her cold. What on earth was she thinking? I couldn't.
One night, for 10 minutes. We'll leave in separate carriages, then I'll join you nearby.
His face grew serious.
I think we both know this time next week, our friendship will be swallowed up by society's dictates. Shall we enjoy it now, while we have it?
He held her gaze.
No one will know. I promise.
Had her mother heard the same words at some point? No. Sarah was wrong to romanticize her mother's relationship with his lordship. That wasn't the case at all. The man was known as a beast throughout the county, one who whipped the boys who poached on his land. Her mother had been tricked, seduced against her will. The offer from Mr. Camden was nothing like that. He was American, for a start, and believed that all people, regardless of standing, deserved a chance. He'd seen something in her back in London, and given her the greatest opportunity of her life. And now he was asking her to the ball, but not as Prince Charming, as a co-witness to the madness of the elite. This was the class of people the residents of the Dakota wished to be like, in their heart of hearts. By attending, she'd gain a deeper understanding of the resentments, frustrations, and aspirations of the very people for whom she worked. 10 minutes out of her life. 10 minutes of being on Mr. Camden's arm. Only 10 minutes.
Chapter 12. New York City, September 1985.
Where the fuck is everyone?
Melinda tore through the apartment like a well-coiffed whirlwind, dropping her Birkin bag with a thud on the floor. Bailey had been in the kitchen, furiously trying to reach the contractor on the phone, with no luck, when she heard the front door slam and knew exactly who it was. Now, as they faced off down the long gallery, Melinda reminded Bailey of a bull in a bullfight about to charge. A bull wearing Candy's high heels.
So, where are the workers?
Bailey's footsteps echoed through the empty apartment. I'm trying to reach Steve to find out. I don't remember him saying anything about taking the day off. They know we're on a tight schedule.
You bet we are.
I have to ask, did you pay their bill for the next installment? Melinda rolled her eyes.
I think so.
She had her answer. My guess is they've been pulled away on another job.
Why is that?
Because they're due the next installment on their payment and they haven't gotten it yet?
Jesus Christ! Steve knows I'm good for it. I told him my situation.
I'm sure you did, but they don't only work for you. If another job comes along, they'd jump if they aren't happy. Melinda's shoulders dropped a few inches. Progress. Bailey kept talking. I'll try calling them today, see if I can entice them back. But right now, the only thing we know for sure will work is a big fat check.
Fucking Fred won't give me anything early. I've tried already, trust me.
Then maybe it's a good idea to wait until you have the money in hand to continue. Bailey hated saying this. It meant she'd be at loose ends and broke for an extra month. Unlike Melinda's idea of broke, hers actually meant it.
I'll ask Tony. He'll front me the cash.
How soon can you get it?
I'll go by his office today. Tonight we're hitting the limelight, so he'll be in a good mood later, even if he's cranky when I ask for the money.
The limelight. Bailey's jaw tightened and her heart raced. Like Pavlov's dog, she only needed to hear one word. The many nights they'd spent dancing and drinking and doing coke until dawn had imprinted themselves on her. She'd hit an AA meeting at a small church on 69th Street a few nights ago. The place had been packed and the coffee strong. She listened to the stories and nodded encouragement, but felt like a fraud, like an actor in a movie about recovery, playing the role of the penitent sinner. Until one woman brought her to tears with her story about waking up in an apartment in the Bronx, beaten and sore, not remembering how she'd ended up there. The bruise around her eye had faded to a shadow, but her words and anguish were still raw. So many nights, especially during the last year, Bailey hadn't been sure how she'd gotten herself home. She dodged a bullet. Maybe a whole cartridge of bullets. As she turned to leave, she spotted Renzo standing in the very back. He disappeared in a flash, but she was sure it was him. It made her feel defenseless and small, knowing that he had stared at the back of her head the past hour, knowing that he knew. A couple of days later, when she'd been showing Kenneth the wallpaper choices for his bathroom, Renzo stopped by to inspect the work the plumber was doing. She tried to shape her expression into a smile that meant, "Your secret's safe with me," but he had barely made eye contact. Maybe none of the other tenants knew he had a problem, and he wanted to keep it that way. That was fine with her. Still, he could have been nicer. Melinda picked up her Birkin and brushed imaginary dust from her denim culottes.
"You should come with us tonight, Bales. It'll be like old times."
"Are you kidding? I just got back from rehab. The limelight is the last place I need to be."
"Fine. Then come to dinner with us beforehand at the Odeon. You don't need to drink, and it'll be better than sitting in this tomb. You look so pale. Have you had any fun since you've been back?"
"I don't have the funds for fun right now."
"It's on me and Tony tonight, okay? Our treat."
If Bailey had another slice of pizza for dinner, she'd lose her mind. The thought of a real meal, with cloth napkins and waiters, seemed like an exotic expedition. She could use the change of scenery. "What time?"
9 o'clock.
So late. "I'm not sure. There's no way I can go back to partying like I used to." Melinda punched her playfully on the arm.
"I know. I don't mean to push you. I just want to get you back in my life. I've missed you."
"You have me. I'm not going anywhere. Unlike your contractor."
"And I'm so happy about that. And I want you to join us, okay?"
Bailey agreed, touched by Melinda's insistence. Her choice of clothing for the evening was limited. She had some indigo jeans and a pair of high heels, but the only nice item for going out to dinner was a sequined top that tied around her neck and exposed much of her shoulders. She found it wedged into a corner of her suitcase, underneath the sensible t-shirt she'd brought with her to rehab. It was risque for the Dakota, but not for Odeon. Of course, Renzo was in the porter's office as she passed through the porte cochere. She looked like she was heading out for a good time, and it put a lump of guilt in her belly. He waved at her from the window, and she waved back without smiling. What business was it of his where she was going or what she looked like? Who was he to judge? The man was the super of a building in New York City, not a potential client or friend. The need to please him pissed her off, and the feeling didn't go away until she was in a subway car hurtling downtown. Tony stood and pulled out a chair for her as Bailey entered the restaurant. The room was loud and crowded, and a couple of men's heads turned as she walked by. It was nice to know she wasn't all washed up. The liquor bottles behind the bar glittered like jewels as Prince sang about raspberry berets from the speakers. She ached for a drink. If she wanted to stay in New York, she'd have to learn to manage temptation. And tonight was her first real test. Her hand fluttered to her throat. It was all she could do not to claw at it, as she ordered a seltzer with lime before thanking Tony for letting her be a third wheel.
"Not at all. We missed you terribly."
His accent was so posh. The fact that most of what he said was gossip and self-congratulation tended to be forgotten by his listeners, including Melinda, who doted on the man. The few times Bailey had asked Tony what exactly he did for a living, he'd brushed her off with tales of dashing around Ibiza with his university chums. He had an air of wealth, which meant the other details didn't matter. Although, to be fair, Tony had stuck by Melinda and was basically supporting her lavish lifestyle these days, at least until the trust fund kicked in. A good boyfriend to have. He had widely spaced eyes, sparse eyelashes, and a jet-black, gelled mane that shot out of his hairline like the edge of a well-manicured lawn. He'd gone to either Oxford or Cambridge, and Bailey knew better than to ask again and risk his derision for failing to remember the correct answer. Tony ordered another round of drinks. Bailey got the steak frites and dove into the breadbasket as soon as it arrived.
"Take it easy, Tiger," said Melinda. "It's like you haven't eaten in days."
She put the piece of bread back on her plate and took a sip of seltzer. The place was buzzing with coke-fueled energy. Being here sober wasn't much fun. Too loud, impossible to talk. Tony said something and she leaned forward. "What did you say?"
"You're looking awfully good these days. Rehab agrees with you."
He looked her up and down and she squirmed.
"He means you've got a figure, doll."
Melinda pointed to Bailey's breasts.
"Filled out."
She turned to Tony.
"I blossomed before Bailey, even though she's a year older than me."
Bailey put her elbows on the table, eager to stop Tony from checking her out further, as if this could get any more uncomfortable.
"Remember the holiday visit when you tried on one of my bras and we stuffed it with socks?"
Melinda threw back her head and laughed, exposing her neck.
"My mother took one look and practically spit up her tea."
Certain memories were made to be quashed, and that was one of them. The pressure of the bra around her chest had been unfamiliar and tight, but made her feel grown up, and she draped one of Melinda's soft cashmere sweaters over it. She thought she stepped into the room full of adults looking like one herself, but her father had turned beet red, and her mother had gasped before insisting she change right away. "I do remember."
"We were silly kids."
Melinda linked arms with Tony.
"In fact, Tony and I were just discussing the possibility of having kids of our own the other day, weren't we?"
Tony patted her arm.
"Right."
Thank God the subject had changed. Melinda put her face right next to Tony's.
"Can you imagine how cute our baby would be?"
She kissed him on the cheek before wiping off the waxy smudge with her finger.
"Or babies. You know, twins run in my family. They'd be the perfect mix of my brains and your good looks."
Bailey almost choked on her seltzer, and she could have sworn Tony grimaced.
"Your brains?"
he inquired. Melinda leaned over the table and spoke in a mock whisper.
"Tony never passed his exams at university, but don't tell anyone that. He doesn't like to talk about it."
Tony bristled.
"Only one exam, my dear. I'd like to see how you would have fared. Not well is my guess. In any case, my family is known for its brilliant men. My cousin, in fact, is going to win a Nobel Prize for science sometime in the near future. I am quite sure of that, so you might want to rethink your judgmental attitude."
"Sorry, Tony."
Melinda batted her eyelids at him. He sniffed and seemed to calm down. Bailey took another piece of bread.
"What's your cousin done that's so amazing?"
"He's invented a way to match DNA to the person it belongs to."
"I don't understand. Of course DNA belongs to the person it came from."
"It'll be used in criminal cases. Like if someone leaves a drop of blood or hair at a crime scene, they can tell exactly who did it. So, say they get a suspect in custody. They do this test and know for certain that they've got the right bloke."
"Gross. Can we not talk about hair and blood right now?"
Melinda made a gagging sound. Bailey ignored her.
"He certainly deserves the Nobel for that. It almost sounds like magic more than science. Did he go to Cambridge as well?"
Tony gave a quick shake of his head, annoyed. She'd got it wrong.
"Oxford. Our family always matriculates at Oxford."
"Right. Sorry."
The food arrived, her steak glistening with juice, but she barely had a few bites before Tony insisted they leave. Bailey didn't want to go clubbing. She preferred to stay there and finish her dinner, but sitting alone at the table would be humiliating. She grabbed a few more fries before following them out the door and into a cab. They pulled up to the former church, where a line of impatient partygoers wrapped around the block. Bailey had every intention of continuing on uptown, but Melinda yanked her out of the taxi. From there, it was as if a magnetic force took over, pulling her past the bouncers and over the gaping maw of the threshold. She vowed to spend only 10 minutes or so at the club as a test of her willpower, until Tony and Melinda were distracted by new friends and new drugs. She checked her watch. She'd be home before midnight and would wake up early in time to attend the 8:30 AA meeting. The theme for the night was Bear as You Dare. Long, skinny limbs erupted every so often from the mash of bodies on the packed dance floor. The lights flashed to the beat of a tom-tom club song, and at times, the dancers seemed like they made up one organism, a pleasure-seeking, pulsating beast. Once inside, Tony and Melinda had peeled off to the right. They were probably in search of more coke, which usually could be found in one of the tiny rooms downstairs, the private areas where clubgoers could writhe around one another, or drop acid, or do whatever else they'd regret in the morning. She climbed the stairs for a better view and leaned over the balcony, scanning the crowd. No familiar faces. 4 months ago, she would have been treated like royalty from the minute she passed the bouncer. As part of Tristan's entourage, doors opened and people sucked up.
"Well, if it isn't the backstabbing bitch, Bailey."
Speak of the devil. Tristan. And not only Tristan, but Wanda and a couple of assistants from the firm, who hovered in the background trying to look bored and cool. "What are you talking about?" She knew it was better to go on the offensive with him, but couldn't think of any other response. He glowered at her.
"You took over Melinda's job, did you? How's that going? Everyone knows your cousin can't pay up. And how do they know that? I told them myself."
That explained the missing crew. Tony's money would solve that problem, but for now she had to deal with Tristan. He'd given her so much, had taken her in and trained her, made her feel smart and talented. She'd once been a lowly assistant, but he'd noticed that she always made the extra effort by staying late and doing whatever it took when an emergency cropped up. "Look, Tristan, I'm sorry for that, really. Melinda's throwing me a bone here. Like you said, she can't even afford it yet. Why would you even want to be bothered with that?"
"You're doing me a favor. Is that how you justify it?"
"No, I don't mean that." Wanda thrust her long neck forward.
"She totally scooped it out from under you, Tristan. I was there."
Tristan sniffed.
"I got you to rehab, and this is what I get in return?"
He was right. Whatever defenses she had left crumbled. "You've done so much for me, Tristan. I'm sorry, I should have come to you first, but it all happened so fast. I was desperate. I didn't have any money, a job, a place to stay. Melinda offered all three, at least temporarily." He cocked his head, mollified for the moment.
"You can have your cousin's apartment. But it's the last job you'll ever do. I won't have you poaching my business. Remember, I can ruin you in this town."
They left Bailey shaking, one hand on the balcony and the other over her heart, which beat as if she'd inhaled an eight ball. Tristan had the power to shut her out of her career completely. Why hadn't she seen that? In rehab, her counselors had advised her to make a plan for when she got out, and she'd considered moving somewhere else, like Los Angeles or San Francisco, to make a fresh start. But that was hard to do when you had no money, no contacts. She should call someone from AA, or her roommate from Silver Hill. Confess that right now all she wanted was a shot of tequila, something searing and quick to take the pain away and the edge off. But the idea of standing on a street corner, putting quarters into a payphone, and waking up a girl she barely even knew was pathetic. Desperate. She wasn't that. Not yet. One drink.
That's all she'd have. Then she'd walk out of here and never come back. Her purse held only a few subway tokens and a $5 bill. She went through all of the side pockets and almost cried with joy when she spotted a 20. Her emergency fund. The tequila was as good as she'd expected it to be. No, better. Hot fire. She would leave after saying goodbye to Melinda and Tony, warning them that Tristan was pissed. She found them in what used to be the undercroft of the church, now decked out with funky couches and low lighting. A line of Coke was laid out on the table in front of them, a bottle of champagne in a bucket on the floor.
Bailey, where have you been? Sit here, give me a kiss.
Melinda was sloppy, happy, and a mess. Bailey sat beside her. Tristan's on the warpath. He's mad that you hired me. Really mad.
Screw him. I'll take care of you. Don't worry about a thing.
She poured Bailey a glass of champagne, spilling some on her lap but not noticing. No, I'm not having any more. Tony leaned forward, a curled-up dollar bill in his hand.
You've already partaken.
Just one. Melinda let out a cackle.
Go on, have a glass of champagne.
The warm feeling from the shot was beginning to dissipate. She could sneak out the back way and catch a cab, go home thinking about the steak she never got to finish. Or she could stay in this one room, deep in the bowels of a building where generations of New Yorkers had found absolution from their sins, and make herself feel good for the next hour or two. Feed that particular appetite. It wasn't even a toss-up.
Chapter 13. New York City. November, 1884. As promised, the carriage stood waiting on 72nd Street, in front of the Dakota, at precisely 11 o'clock. Once inside, Sarah removed her long cape, glad that the evening was quite temperate, and smoothed her dress. She'd spent the past 3 nights hard at work at the tailor's sewing machine, narrowing the silhouette and adjusting the sleeves to bring it up to date. And while it wasn't perfect, it would do. Her hands were clammy in her gloves. At 59th Street, the carriage stopped abruptly. The door opened and Mr. Camden appeared, lit from behind by the lamplights.
Are you ready to see the worst of society?
He took a seat next to her and handed over a delicate mask, decorated with peacock feathers, the blues and greens iridescent. His was painted in antique gold. Even in evening dress, he looked like he'd just come from a fight. With that crooked nose, there was no getting around the fact that he wasn't at all like the upper class. But the delicious discord between his fine clothes and his rugged build took her breath away. Are you sure this is a good idea? She clutched the ties of her mask tightly. It wouldn't do for you to be seen with a member of the staff of the Dakota. They'll have my hide, and yours.
I've informed them that my second cousin, Imogen Cuthberg, will be joining me. We'll flit around the edges before making a run for the door. No one will notice, I promise.
Imogen Cuthberg? Is that the best you can do? He gave her a mock pout.
I'll have you know I do have a second cousin named Imogen Cuthberg, and she's a delightful soul.
He paused, thinking.
Her teeth are quite crooked, and she's not the quickest wit, but delightful nonetheless.
I can only imagine what you see in me in that case. The darkness made her bold.
Lovely teeth, and a rapier-sharp wit, if you must know.
Thankfully, he couldn't see the pink glow that stole up her neck to the top of her head. The carriage finally lurched to a halt in front of the Rutherfords' mansion. Sarah took a deep breath and descended. Now that she was wearing a proper gown, all of her mother's admonishments regarding posture and deportment kicked in, and she glided along the sidewalk to the enormous front door encased by white marble columns.
Inside, they found themselves in a crush of guests. Mr. Camden had said the invitation list numbered over 1,000, and for that she was thankful, as it encouraged anonymity. Everyone was trying to squeeze into the great hall, and Sarah let herself be swept along, with Mr. Camden's hand on her elbow, providing reassurance. He maneuvered them into a corner of an enormous ballroom, where they could gape without being trodden upon. If this night weren't already a dream, the great hall was designed to be just that. Its recessed fountain alcoves and climbing stone vines turned the world inside out. The weight of the rusticated walls added to the soaring illusion of the trompe-l'oeil sky that covered the vaulted ceiling.
"Your dress is lovely."
Mr. Camden took a few steps back, his lips parted. No mirror was needed to know that she filled out the gown nicely. His face showed his delight.
"It matches the flowers."
He pointed to the vase of blush roses that blocked them from view, only one of hundreds of similar arrangements in hues from ivory to crimson. The current craze for indoor greenery was evident as well, with enormous palms and ferns clustered around the marble columns. "It's like a jungle." She was proud and bashful and eager to deflect his attention.
"A jungle with wainscoting stripped from a chateau in France."
"I believe their fireplace rivals ours," Sarah noted. Mr. Camden studied it.
"Carlisle stone and carved oak. Looks about 20 feet wide. The one in the Dakota dining room is a slight 15 feet wide. I do apologize for that, Miss Cuthbert."
"As you should." He might as well have shouted out her true name for all the attention, or lack thereof, they garnered. Mr. Camden purloined a couple of champagne glasses from a passing tray, and handed one to her.
"Come, let's explore."
He took her down a hallway that led away from the crowds, the tails of his dress coat fluttering behind him. "How many servants does it take to keep a place like this running?" she asked. The champagne bubbled in her nose, and she coughed.
"A little under 40, from what I've heard."
He opened a door and raised his eyebrows.
"Here we go."
They stood inside a library, the grandest Sarah had ever seen. Bookshelves lined every wall, 3 levels in all, ringed by narrow balconies. The fireplace of blood-red marble reminded her of a piece of raw steak, streaked with fat. She drew closer, drawn to the figures carved along the mantle, a row of 12 fat babies, all grabbing at one another in anger or churlishness. "What on earth?" Mr. Camden drew closer and sighed.
"I know. Awful, isn't it?"
"I would have thought cherubs would be better suited for such a grand space." She gestured up at the coffered ceiling. "Not these devilish creatures."
"Now do you understand my frustration? To have so much money, to waste it on such garishness."
He turned to her.
"That's why I want to get away from Hardenberg. Start my own firm and begin changing the world, one building at a time. No more European flourishes, straight lines soaring into the sky."
"You're talking about remaking the entire city, aren't you?"
"Maybe I am. Someone must."
Sarah studied the stained glass windows and porcelain vases. "How do you know what's truly valuable when everything is valuable?"
He laughed. "Precisely."
His mask covered his expression, but his eyes danced with pleasure. Sarah froze as a deep voice from the hallway drew closer.
"Someone's coming. What shall we do?"
Mr. Camden took her hand and pulled her into an alcove off the main room, out of sight. She resisted at first, but it was no use. They were trapped. Mr. Camden put his mouth close to her ear.
"We'll stay here, quiet, for a moment. They've probably come for a smoke, and we'll leave soon enough."
Sarah squeezed as far back as she could. Shelves lined the alcove, but instead of leather-bound books, they contained artifacts of all sorts. Ancient manuscripts sat alongside gleaming swords,
and grotesque figurines from some foreign land leered back at them. Terrified she'd knock something over, Sarah stood as still as possible. The squeak of leather, followed by the smell of cigar smoke, indicated that Mr. Camden was correct. The men's voices rose.
"They're running rampant."
The speaker had a grumbly wheeze.
"Why, Mrs. Rutherford was almost leveled by one on Fifth Avenue the other day. Our carriage driver had to give the kid a good beating. No sense, those street children. I wish we could put them on a boat and send them off somewhere," answered another. "They make New York City a dangerous place."
"Such generous souls," muttered Mr. Camden, so quietly Sarah could barely hear him. He picked up a knife that lay on a shelf about hip level. The long, single-edged blade ended in a pointed tip, and the hilt was decorated with gold and silver that had been hammered and patterned into swirls.
"I'm sure the child would have loved to get his hands on one of these, show them what's what. I know I would have. Pompous fools."
"We shouldn't touch anything." She mouthed it more than said it. A woman's high voice broke through the men's murmurs like shattering glass.
"Mr. Rutherford, you can't stay hiding in here. It just won't do."
Mr. Camden set the knife back down, and Sarah huddled closer.
"My dear Mrs. Rutherford, I should have known you'd find us."
After more grumbling, the men shuffled out, leaving behind the fetid odor of cigar smoke. They were no longer playing at mocking the rich. They were hiding out in Mr. Rutherford's private library, eavesdropping, fingering his treasures. Mr. Camden had access to high society through his wife, but Sarah was an absolute imposter. She'd been stupid to come.
"They're gone."
Mr. Camden didn't move.
"Wait a moment. Give them time to disperse."
He drew his hand up and lightly touched Sarah's cheek. She held her breath, riveted by the steely look in his eyes.
"You're lovely."
The gesture's power was as physical as if he'd crushed her in his embrace. Even though she lacked the wealth or standing of the other guests, Mr. Camden didn't care. His own humble background meant that he understood Sarah more than anyone else ever had. He saw her not as a servant or supervisor, but as a woman. He touched his finger to her lips.
"We must go back to the Dakota. Now."
By the time they returned home, it was after 1 in the morning. The building quiet as a cathedral. Theo insisted Sarah join him for a glass of sherry. In his parlor, she let the cape fall from her shoulders and placed it on a nearby chair while he poured their drinks. She'd never wear such a delicious dress again. So many temptations, all for such a short time. When the sun rose, she'd be back at work, taking care of everyone else's complaints. But the night was her own. He returned and placed a glass in her hand, and they settled on the settee.
"May I call you Sarah?"
She nodded. "You may."
"And will you call me Theo?"
"Of course. In private." He sighed.
"We're a couple of misfits, I know. The only reason a lowly architect is allowed to a ball is because his wife has standing, while you are the daughter of an earl, and yet you must sneak in under an assumed name."
"If you remember, neither of us is interested in that sort of life, only to laugh."
"But it bothers me. The thought of you toiling away in this prison, managing the likes of Mrs. Haynes and Fitzroy. You deserve so much better."
She laughed. "You call this a prison?"
"A magnificent prison."
"We all have our own magnificent prisons. Even the Queen, I'd venture."
"Now you're getting all philosophical on me."
He sipped his sherry.
"Do you know who you reminded me of tonight?"
She shook her head.
"Cinderella, at the ball, anonymous and beautiful.
If so, I seem to have left with both slippers and without my prince. The intimacy was too much to bear. She set down her glass and rose to her feet. Please, I must be going. I don't want to keep you up any later than necessary. He stood and handed her the mask.
Will you keep this as a remembrance?
I'd like that. She smoothed the feathers. Thank you, Theo. He moved closer. Unexpected memories, horrible ones, filled her head. Of Mr. Ainsworth's tongue, his hands on her. Blood. She braced herself, uncertain of what to do next. Theo stayed still as well, waiting, watching her.
Tell me.
I can't. The darkness, the misery of what she'd done almost made her weep. She turned toward the fire, staring, watching the flames.
Was it something I did?
Anguish in his voice. No, of course not.
I hope you understand what a friend you've been to me, how much I've enjoyed having you near. I don't mean to make you uncomfortable, and I apologize if I have, by being too close.
It's not that. Not that at all. If only she could explain.
Then what?
She began speaking, uncertain at first what she'd reveal. When I was young, I was sent to an apprenticeship for sewing. Mrs. Ainsworth was a horrible sort, and she'd keep us working late into the evening, when your eyes strained from the effort of properly stitching by candlelight. But where she was mean, her husband was jolly, sweet. He'd slip us butterscotch candies and praise our work. I didn't realize that he was preying on the other girls. One by one he'd get them alone. At the time, though, I thought his attention meant I was special.
You were a young girl. Innocent.
Mrs. Ainsworth was working on a gown for a countess. Sarah plucked at the fabric of her skirt. This gown. When it was almost finished, she had me try it on, to check the length. He came in when I was wearing it. She didn't mention the look Mr. Ainsworth had given her, one of pleasure and longing, how she'd been pleased by her power. She didn't tell Theo how the other girls had warned her about Mr. Ainsworth's attentions that afternoon, and told her of the sick things he'd forced them to do. The bloom of her schoolgirl flirtation had rotted away, replaced by embarrassment and disgust. And rage. Late that night, she asked me to finish the trim, and Mr. Ainsworth snuck in behind me. I didn't hear him. Theo shook his head. He leaned over me, one hand on the table, and whispered awful things while pressing against my back. For a moment I froze, but then I did something horrible. She took a deep breath, remembering the cold feel of steel under her fingers. I picked up the scissors and stabbed his hand right through to the tabletop.
Then what happened?
Theo turned her to face him, but she couldn't meet his eyes. She breathed in his scent of oranges and smoke. I ran upstairs, still holding the gown, packed up my things and ran off to London. Took a job as a maid in a horrible place, a seedy inn, and worked my way up.
Goodness, Sarah. What you've been through. What you've done.
He lifted her chin and stared down at her.
I understand completely, though. I would have done the same to my stepfather.
You would?
1 year, for my mother's birthday, I had made a book of sketches for her. Drawings of castles and manor houses. One of her in a fancy dress, similar to the one you're wearing now, even though she'd never owned such a gown in her life. She lingered over each page, running her fingers over the lines like they were braille. But it enraged my stepfather.
He insisted that she toss the sketchbook in the fire. He knew doing so would kill her spirit. And mine. The triumph in his eyes as she placed it onto the flames made me wish I had a gun. I would have shot him in the face. He rubbed his eyes, as if trying to erase the memory. I'm sorry.
What for?
She wanted him to keep talking, to extend the agony of being so close as long as possible.
I can't seem to stay away from you. If something ridiculous happens with one of the tenants or the construction workers, you are the person I want to share it with right off. I worry I've overstepped, and I have tried at times to pull back.
I understand. You were doing the proper thing.
I'd never want you to think of me like Mr. Ainsworth, but... Sarah, I don't want to do the proper thing anymore.
She, not he, initiated the kiss.
The silk gown slipped from her shoulders like rose petals in the heat of summer, and with it went her troubled memories of Mr. Ainsworth. Then Theo took her, carefully and gently, in front of the fire. Sarah let herself go, lost herself in the shadows of the Dakota, within the thick walls that shut out all sounds and fears.
Mrs. Camden is here!
Daisy flew into Sarah's office, her cheeks a rosy red. Sarah hadn't gotten any sleep the previous night, slinking back to her room from Theo's, peacock mask in hand, as dawn broke. Maybe she'd misheard.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Camden's wife and children arrived. They're heading up to their apartment now, and Mrs. Camden said she had to see you right away.
But she's not due until next Thursday, isn't she?
The question was a silly one, and didn't alter the fact that the woman was in the Dakota already. But Sarah needed to buy time to absorb this new information.
I know, but she's here now. The children are adorable, all dressed alike. I'm going to do just the same when I have children.
I'll be there right away. In the meantime, call the maids for that floor to unpack their belongings.
The unexpected, strident note in her voice drew Daisy up short.
Yes, ma'am.
After the girl had closed the door behind her, Sarah rose and went to the window. What did she hope to see? Theo striding across the courtyard, ready to take her in his arms and tell her he loved her? Of course not. It had been a momentary dream when they both escaped into another world, fueled by the ostentatious beauty of the people and surroundings at the ball. Now it was over. She wished she could hide up in her room and sleep. Sleep until years had passed and Theo no longer lived here, and she could go about her duties without hoping she'd run into him around every corner. Theo's apartment was a bustle of activity, porters heaving in trunks, and the maids scrambling around like a flock of white-capped geese. She hesitated in the foyer, one hand on the brass fireplace, listening. A woman's voice, with a melodic English inflection, rose above the rest.
Now, Emily, I'm sure your doll is here somewhere. You must be patient, and she'll turn up eventually.
Sarah moved forward. In the parlor stood the woman Sarah recognized from the day at the Langham. Her hair was perfectly coiffed on her head in blonde waves, and she wore a navy plaid traveling dress. The woman was beautiful, Sarah had to admit. Her fairness of skin and hair would have washed her out completely, except for her enormous green-gold eyes and those lashes, so black they looked like they came from someone else entirely. No doubt Theo had been captivated the first time he'd laid eyes on her. She was an artist's dream. She stood very upright in the middle of the room, speaking to a girl Sarah recognized as the older daughter from the day at the Langham. The girl's hair was a thick brunette, much like Theo's.
Mrs. Camden!
Sarah's voice gave an unexpected squeak. She cleared her throat.
I am Mrs. Smythe, the manageret.
Right.
We met in London.
Yes.
Mrs. Camden stepped forward, holding out a gloved hand. You saved my daughter Lula that day, and I was never able to thank you properly. Luckily, Mr. Camden insisted you come all the way to America with us, so I am finally able to do so.
Sarah paused. She'd forgotten the pliability of an English accent. With a slight change in the tone of voice, it was easy to make a statement an accusation, or have it drip with sarcasm. Her first week at the Dakota, Sarah had realized that Americans didn't understand the subtext behind her voice. She had to spell out exactly what she needed, as well as the urgency, and couldn't depend upon a phrase like, "I do hope you'll find it in you to show up on time for work," to do the trick. There was an underlying message beneath Mrs. Camden's statement. A warning. Or was she imagining things?
No thanks are necessary. In any event, we're having some difficulty getting settled. The beds in the children's room need to be moved around. I don't like the placement.
Of course.
Many.
Theo strode into the room, but stopped when he spotted Sarah. For a moment the two remained frozen, their eyes fused on each other, before the young girl rushed to him.
Papa!
Theo knelt down and took her in his arms.
My darling Emily, what an unexpected delight!
He looked up at his wife.
You arrived early.
We certainly did. The seas were in our favor.
She gestured to Sarah.
I was just giving Mrs. Smythe her instructions. That's all for now, Mrs. Smythe.
Of course. She burned with shame.
Wait.
Theo's voice stopped her in her tracks.
Mrs. Smythe, thank you for your assistance.
She refused to meet his gaze. You're welcome.
But my doll...
Emily grabbed her father's sleeve.
She's gone, and Mummy won't do anything about it.
Enough. A weariness in Mrs. Camden's voice reminded Sarah of her first day in New York City, and she felt a small pang of sympathy.
The maids are busy unpacking, but I'm certain Mrs. Smythe might help you.
The pang dissipated.
Mrs. Smythe has other duties I'm sure she must take care of, said Theo.
For a moment, Sarah was tongue-tied, until the girl gave her a shy smile.
Would you please?
She asked.
Of course.
As Sarah led the girl from the parlor, she overheard Mrs. Camden speaking to Theo.
I thought our apartment would be much farther along. The bedchambers are in a terrible state.
I've been working, Minnie.
The woman didn't answer him. She imagined them in an embrace, Theo kissing his wife. The taste of his lips and mouth were still on her own. Sarah and Emily searched for the doll for only a couple of minutes, before Sarah discovered it wedged between a dresser and the wall. They were soon joined by the twins, Lula and Luther. Lula, the girl Sarah had saved that day that now seemed so long ago, marched over to Sarah and yanked on her skirt, before running back to her brother with a sly smile. A spirited child, Sarah decided. Too bold by far, which explained her near disaster in London. The boy had pretty blonde curls like his sister, but hung back, uncertain. Having found the doll for Emily, Sarah left, closing the apartment's front door behind her with a solid click. She vowed to steer clear of the entire family from now on.
Sarah.
Theo was waiting in the corridor.
I'm so sorry. We didn't have even a minute together. I wanted to apologize.
She looked up at him. No need to apologize. It's better this way.
But last night...
Let's not talk about it. The wail of a child rose from behind the door. Another crisis. You must go back to your family. Instead of waiting for the elevator, Sarah took the stairs,
careful to make sure her footsteps echoed evenly up the stairwell. Even though she wanted more than anything to run willy-nilly away from the man she'd been running toward for the past month. That evening, she wished she could eat her supper alone in the staff dining hall. But Daisy and Mrs. Haynes waved her over to their table, where they sat with a young woman who had a vacant stare and chestnut hair.
"This is Miss Honeycutt, the nanny for the Candons," said Daisy by way of introduction.
Sarah gave the girl a curt nod. "Please let me know if the family needs anything as they settle in."
"Of course. So far, all seems to be calm, though you never know what's going to spring up."
Her features, though pleasant, were scrunched close together in a frame of her face.
"Have you worked for the family for very long?" asked Mrs. Haynes, skewering a piece of potato with her fork.
"I took over in the summer, after they let the previous nanny go. The children seem delightful."
Daisy propped her elbow on the table and fiddled with a loose curl.
"They're a handful."
Miss Honeycutt gave a sweet smile.
"I tell you, it'll be a reprieve to have Mr. Camden around more, to provide a fatherly sense of discipline to them.
He's quite busy with his work."
Sarah hadn't meant to bring attention to herself. Mrs. Haynes cocked her head, curious.
"I mean, even though the Dakota is up and running, he's off to work on the next project for Mr. Hardenberg. I'd advise you to keep a close eye on the little girl, Lula. She has more temerity than most girls of her age."
The nanny nodded.
"I agree. Quite the sprite." "What's Mrs. Camden like?" asked Daisy.
Sarah knew she should stop her from prying, but she wanted to hear the answer. She sipped her tea in an effort to help the mutton haricot go down easier. The cook would need a good talking to, as the servants' dinners were in stark contrast to the delicacies from the picnic. Sarah added that to her list of tomorrow's duties. Miss Honeycutt waved her fork about, thrilled to have an audience.
"She's quiet, often takes to bed with some illness or another. Too bad, as she has the most beautiful dresses. I don't know if she'll be able to manage up here in the wilderness. I hear it takes forever just to get into town."
"The city is gradually moving north." Sarah couldn't help herself. "There are some grand mansions on Fifth Avenue in the 50s, and they say they may build along the park as well. We happen to be the first."
"Can't happen soon enough for me," said Daisy. "Did you hear about the masquerade ball at the Rutherfords last night?"
"No, what about it?"
Miss Honeycutt practically jumped out of her seat. Daisy had met her match when it came to dreaming.
"It's in the afternoon paper. They had over 1,000 guests, but someone stole some kind of treasure."
Mrs. Haynes sniffed.
"Treasure? What treasure?"
Daisy looked about and lowered her voice, eager to share the intrigue.
"This morning, they discovered a valuable knife was missing from Mr. Rutherford's library. Worth thousands of dollars. From Tibet it was."
The image of the gold and silver plated handle popped into Sarah's head. She'd stood less than a foot away from it. What if Theo thought she'd taken it? She cleared her plate and sent a porter with a sealed note to Theo, asking him to meet her on the roof at 8 o'clock. As she paced and waited for him, the silliness of her actions became clear. She'd been desperate for a chance to speak with him, and had used the knife as an excuse. She was about to run back downstairs when he appeared. He looked around and then stumbled over to her, pulling her into his arms. This was what she'd wanted, more than anything, to be held by him one last time.
"My dear, I am so sorry we didn't get any time to speak. I was about to come to you when I received your note."
He pulled her to a corner where the chimney rose up, and leaned her against the brick. His hand stroked her face down to her chin, which he held with his index finger and thumb.
"This is what I like. This is what I want."
He kissed her then, long and sweet,
peppered with small strokes of his tongue that made her insides turn over. After a moment, she leaned her head on his shoulder. The cool air whipped her face, but she didn't want to go back down. "Did you hear that something went missing from the Rutherford Library last night?" Theo threw his head back and laughed.
"Was that you? Do I need to search you for contraband?"
"It was right where we were standing."
"Probably one of the servants. In any case, I wouldn't..."